Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 18th of May. Monday at 9 is All Things Political. Our guest this hour has joined us many times before, Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. We have a lot to talk about, the president's appearance at Notre Dame, the country's thoughts about the issue of abortion. We'll talk about Supreme Court nominations and news over the weekend that there are memorandums from the Republican Party, and according to the New York Times, they are dissecting possible nominees' records, noting statements they find objectionable on issues like abortion, same-sex marriage, the separation of church and state, and the propriety of citing foreign law in interpreting the Constitution. What about withholding pictures of torture in Iraq and Afghanistan? Is there potential harm for publicizing those? What about the trouble that Nancy Pelosi is in? Was she briefed by the CIA on waterboarding, knew when it started or not? And we have a new ambassador to China, and the list goes on. Your phone calls are always welcome. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email this morning, you can do that. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent, is our guest. Hello, Chase. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you here. Let's start with President Obama's appearance at Notre Dame University over the weekend, walking into the abortion debate, saying that, you know, on this issue, there may be irreconcilable differences, but he brought up the issue anyhow. Why did he do that?
Yeah, it was an interesting speech, just from the sense that, you know, he went to Notre Dame, and a lot of folks expected him to address the issue of abortion, and I was frankly most surprised simply by the fact that he admitted that both sides of that debate are probably on some level irreconcilable. And he still made a call for both sides to work together on the points of their agendas that they can agree on. But it struck me that he was willing to simply admit flat out in a setting that's typically, you know, optimistic and forward-looking, that there are two diametrically opposed sides to this debate that, you know, may never really agree with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting.
There was some poll that was released recently that was cited over the weekend that shows that it's a Gallup poll, actually, that the pro-life position is now embraced by 51% of the American people, pro-choice 42%. When you look at a year ago, it was 50% pro-choice, 44% pro-life. You've got to put a grain of salt with polls, but why do you think there's such a change here?
Sure. You know, that's a question that a lot of folks have that, frankly, I saw that poll and I can't think of an easy way of explaining it. You know, most of the polling that we've seen before, you know, just in recent years shows that that younger folks are generally likely to be pro-choice, you know, slightly more likely to be pro-abortion rights than against abortion rights compared to people older than them. And it seems that's been the trend for quite some time. But, yeah, for some reason, I frankly think the jury's still out on whether that particular Gallup poll was more of a blip or whether that really does represent some big shift. Because, you know, if those poll numbers are accurate, I think that was the largest shift in that number nationwide, you know, in a very long time, perhaps in the history of Gallup, if I remember what I was reading correctly. So it was a major shift in that direction that the country hadn't seen anything like in a long time. So, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure how much stock to put in it. I do think it's very interesting, and it could be, at the very least, a bit telling about how the sort of rhetorical boundaries of that debate are shifting a bit, because that Gallup poll, I believe, did ask the question in those terms, pro-life or pro-choice, rather than using the more, you know, generic, less loaded terms that,
right,
you know, that some pollsters would say would give you a more accurate number.
Mm-hmm.
So it is worth taking those numbers with a grain of salt, but I do think it's interesting. I just, you know, I'm sorry to say, I don't know if I can explain it.
Well, I don't think I could either. I didn't quite get it. Press was also paying attention to the fact that President Bush spoke at Notre Dame in 2001, President Reagan in 81, both favored the death penalty, which the Catholic Church opposes, but there wasn't any great demonstration or controversy about either of those presidents appearing at the university. Why over
right.
the issue of abortion and not the death penalty?
I think that's just another one where over the years it has become more of a political cause. You know, abortion has become, I think actually the unique thing about the abortion debate compared to other debates, like, say, the death penalty debate, is that both political parties see it as in their interest to, you know, very publicly seek whichever side of that debate they are on and to publicly seek that agenda. You know, both the Democrats see it as an issue where their position is more popular than the Republican positions, that particular Gallup poll notwithstanding. So they're happy to talk about a woman's right to choose, and generally they're happy to, you know, do what they can to defend that right, at least, you know, in speeches and in high profile events. And the Republicans are the same way. You know, they see that as an opportunity to help mobilize their base. They see it as all upside for them when they can talk about abortion. So I think that's part of what makes abortion such a third rail issue, is that on both sides there are very powerful interests who think that it's worth their while to, you know, make as divisive a speech or hold as visible a press conference or protest as they can, unlike, say, the death penalty, where in a lot of cases, you know, the side that is against the death penalty politically wants to say that quietly because they'll look soft on crime if they don't. And, mm-hmm. you know, we could go through a longer list of examples like that. But I think it's interesting, and another example, you know, the Catholic Church has a pretty strong history of being anti-war, with a few prominent exceptions. And, you know, the same thing would go for that. There weren't many war protests when Bush spoke. Of course, there are always some that follow the president around, whoever the president may be, but certainly nothing, you know, it didn't make the national news as the main story coming out of the speech when President Bush did that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the issue of the president changing his position, deciding to withhold pictures of detainee abuse, torture in Iraq and Afghanistan. Talking about the potential harm that could come from this. Why do you think there, we'll get into Nancy Pelosi in a moment, but why do you think he changed his position on that? And it does seem to me as though those pictures are going to come out in one way or another anyhow.
Yeah, you know, that's it's the sort of thing where this is really the first time where President Obama has, at least where I feel like a promise that he made while I was in the room has been broken. mm-hmm. You know, watching him back during the Iowa caucuses in 2007, this was something that he very specifically addressed. You know, the release of these photos was one example of the sort of transparency that he wanted his administration to have, in contrast to the former President Bush's administration. And so, you know, he made a very specific point of talking about these sorts of photos. I think since then, of course, he's realized that as commander-in-chief, he has to keep the military working on his side, or, you know, he'll get into trouble simply with people not, you know, correctly executing orders or whatever. Not that I would expect that to happen very much, but perhaps he fears that, just as he feared, you know, having poor morale at the CIA. You know, I think he realizes now that he's taken office that our intelligence community and even just our larger defense community is really having morale problems right now. And the extent to which he may be overstating that, I don't want to guess, but I think that certainly is at least one of the factors in play. And then I think, you know, another one of the issues is simply that he's headed to Egypt for a big speech in the first week of June, and releasing these photos right before he gives what I think is, you know, being billed as sort of his coming out party to the Muslim world, or his, you know, his big speech laying out what his agenda will be to the Muslim world. You know, releasing these photos right before that, I think he may fear would just, you know, ruin the impact of his speech, and, you know, perhaps set some diplomatic goals back by a couple of years. So I think, you know, there are all of those concerns. But I also think that his White House is smart enough to know, and, you know, he personally, being a constitutional lawyer, probably smart enough to know that the Supreme Court will likely in the end end up ordering him to release these photos. Perhaps that really is his goal in the end, to just be forced to release them so that he doesn't have to take the political risk of releasing the photos and then, you know, putting the troops in danger. He'd rather it be someone else's fault. Again, a very crass political thing, but
an easy way out.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And what do you, if these were published, and the likelihood is that they will be published, perhaps some of them by June, do you think that it could ruin the impact of the speech in Egypt? Is that valid?
Well, you know, frankly, I think it's safe to say that the first photos from Abu Ghraib were, you know, damaging to the point where people still talk about them on the world stage today. You know, they were a pretty horrible embarrassment for all Americans. I think we can all agree on that. And it definitely did set back our diplomatic goals, whether that's for good or for bad, and whether over the long term, we would have been worse served by keeping the photos under wraps and letting it come to light 10 years from now. That's a question for somebody more important than either of us, I'm afraid. But I think, at the same time, that there certainly are those types of questions in play.
Nancy Pelosi, briefed by the CIA, knew about waterboarding, didn't know about waterboarding. She was on the spot last week, and she's not off the spot on this one, is she?
No, she's not. And this is getting, I think, pretty interesting. I think, a few of the really conservative Republicans in Congress who, have had problems with Speaker Pelosi for long before she assumed her speakership are trying to use this as an opportunity to, make sure that everybody remembers that Nancy Pelosi threw down the gauntlet against the CIA. I think some assume, perhaps, inappropriately at this point, that the speaker is lying about what this briefing said. I'm most interested in Senator Bob Graham's account, since he was receiving those same briefings as the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time, and he was apparently a very copious note taker. He kept notes on everything, which I get the sense maybe Speaker Pelosi's office didn't do that for some of these intelligence briefings, just because confidential intelligence briefings, you don't always want to keep written notes. But apparently Senator Graham did, and according to his written notes, he believes that the truth lines up more closely with Speaker Pelosi than with the CIA's account. And, I think it's just going to take some time before both sides of that, learn what they are and aren't allowed to disclose to the public, and somehow it gets worked out. But at this point, it appears to be a pretty, big battle brewing between the Speaker of the House and, a huge intelligence body.
Right.
And, that's, I guess, only time will tell, but perhaps we won't even find out the truth ever, because it is the CIA, after all.
Mm-hmm. You can understand, Chase, I'm sure, why the president would want to move forward here. It's his administration now, and yet all these things from the Bush administration in terms of the war in Iraq, lack of resources for Afghanistan, the issue of torture, waterboarding, et cetera, keeps surfacing. Do you think that is an indication that we do need some kind of deep congressional investigation, blue ribbon commission, somebody to look at what happened here, what was legal, what wasn't, so that we can all learn from this, from mistakes, or not?
Yeah, my personal belief on that is obviously yes, and as a journalist, my thought is always that sunshine is the best antiseptic, and whether or not there are prosecutions, whether it would even be logistically possible to have sworn testimony without giving immunity to everyone or what, I'm not sure, but I do think that it is everyone's job to make sure that in a year or two from now we know exactly what happened, and that the history books will show it accurately. And at the very least, I think that's our responsibility. Beyond that, whether there are prosecutions or just, grants of immunity for testimony for a truth commission or something like that, again, I don't know which one of those I'd prefer, but I do think that we just have to know the truth. It has to be presented to us and investigated by somebody who isn't, overtly politically motivated. It has to, we have to believe it's true, I think, as part of the national healing process, or it won't work.
Hmm. Well, we'll ask the audience that question. Do we have to know the truth about this? It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 18th of May. Chase Martin is our guest, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. We're talking about a number of issues. We haven't even moved on to some of the other issues. The president also appointed the ambassador to China, which is a pretty important position. He's going to be dealing with the Supreme Court nomination. That could be happening pretty soon, maybe even by the end of the week. New York Times saying today that while conservatives say they know they have little chance of defeating Mr. Obama's choice because Democrats control the Senate, they say they hope to mount a fight that could help refill depleted coffers and galvanize a movement demoralized by Republican electoral defeats. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Chase now, 800-486-8655. Mike from Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I have two quick comments. I wasn't listening to Joy's show real close, so I don't know if Chris Amity from ACLU had discussed this, but what I heard that is that the reason they want those photographs and the reason they want more of the records is to show that the torture was not just a few rogue privates or sergeants that were involved in it. This was systemic. They want to show that this wasn't, the people that were punished were these low-level military people, and they want to show that this was not just in Abu Ghraib and in the other military base. But my other question is regarding are our presidents afraid of the military? And I'm the reason I'm asking this is because since Carter had a deal with things going on behind his back concerning the hostages and arms and the trade of arms for hostages thing, I'm wondering, and even as far back as Major General Smedley Butler in the 30s when he was recruited to overthrow the FDR administration, what I'm wondering is, with when Clinton came in and he said, gays in the military, and he backtracked on that when the military kind of, it seemed to me that they said, that, no way, dude. And then Obama comes in, and within 100 days, he backtracks on something that was real important to him, because the CIA and the military seem to me, in this country, maybe we need to be more aware of how much power they actually have and what and what they have to say. Rules. I mean, if a president can't count on the military, and if they can't count on the CIA, my feeling is that they're in big trouble. And one of the guys that has a lot of information regarding this is Ray McGovern, who's done a lot of speaking around the country, and he gives a kind of a clue to what's going on behind the closed doors in the CIA. So anyway, okay. I was wondering if you could address that.
Thanks. All right, Mike. Thanks.
Sure. Well, I think it certainly is true that throughout history, the executive branch has had an interesting relationship with the agencies that it governs, including the Defense Department and, you know, all the intelligence agencies. I don't see a broad conspiracy, you know, that would rise to the level of a coup or anything close to that happening in this administration. You know, I think at least publicly, most administration officials would explain this phenomenon away as a bit more harmless than, you know, than anything like that. But at the same time, you know, there are a lot of career bureaucrats and a lot of career military officials and career analysts who are not political appointees, both in the Defense Department and at the CIA and in the FBI. And I think it's those folks that the president would say he's most worried about, because when those folks feel like, you know, that their work is being overly politicized, that you know, any report that they've ever written is becoming a political football or anything like that, the fear is that they won't do their job as well, or they will feel inhibited. They will feel like, you know, they can't do their job with the creativity they would like, because 5 years from now, Congress might be looking over their shoulder. I think it's that sort of fear that they have, whether or not it's founded or unfounded. And, you know, I think you could make the case that it's pretty much unfounded, that this fear would really stop someone from, you know, doing something vital to national security. But I think that's the main fear, that it would be an issue of morale, and it would be an issue of just people second-guessing themselves too much when there's no time to second-guess on a national security question. So I think it's closer to that than it is to any real fear of a, you know, violent overthrow or, you know, intentional acts of treason. I think it's more just the question of, you know, what will the operating philosophy of the CIA be, and, you know, do you want them to be sharing everything with you, or do you want them to feel, you know, to second guess themselves before they go to the president with something because they fear, you know, investigations 5 years from now?
We go next to Amy from Madison. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about the Nancy Pelosi story. I think it's pretty clear that the CIA, as they say, cooked the books regarding the evidence leading up to the Iraq War. We all know that they put out lies about weapons of mass destruction and so forth, whether it's because of the pressure from the Bush administration or otherwise. So I don't see why it's so hard to believe that the CIA would lie to Congress. I feel like especially the Republicans are being very self-righteous about this, and I don't hear any of the talking heads talking about how the CIA has already lied about the war.
I think that's a very fair point. And I think part of the reason that you don't hear a lot of talking heads yet talking about this is really because there is no evidence either way yet. We really don't know whom to believe. The Speaker of the House has made some allegations against the CIA that, if true, are, you know, very damaging to the CIA, and if false, are going to be so easy to prove false that one would wonder why the Speaker would have ever said these things if they're not true. But at the same time, we just don't know yet. And the folks who do know the answer to this either have ulterior motives that, you know, we can't really trust what they say, or, you know, they aren't really allowed to say enough or disclose enough that we would be satisfied that we have the truth. And so I think it really is just at this point a question of waiting. And in the meantime, both sides are going to use this as a political issue, and you know, they're going to yell at the top of their lungs that the Speaker should resign and all of that. But we have no basis for forming any sort of conclusion one way or the other yet, except, you know, to assume that the Speaker probably wouldn't have done this if she thought she was going to get caught in a lie. And, you know, I would bet that the CIA probably didn't, you know, unintentionally neglect to fully brief Congress. So, you know, there probably is something going on there. But we just don't know. And I think that's the big problem right now. Nobody's really talking about anything substantial as it relates to this question about the Speaker and the CIA, simply because we don't have anything substantial that we know yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think, Amy, about what Leon Panetta had to say, who's now the head of the CIA, that, you know, essentially she was wrong about this. She was briefed. He's from California. He was a big supporter of hers.
I'm sorry, Kathleen, was that for me or was that for...
Oh, Amy, yeah, I don't know if Amy's still there. Amy? Amy's gone, but what do you think? Amy, maybe... There, Amy, what do you think?
Well, maybe Leon Panetta feels that he has to represent the CIA, and he's putting a kind of spin on it. I saw something that he said recently that... What was something like, the CIA isn't in the business of misleading people. So that was a way of kind of protecting the CIA, but maybe suggesting that there was a possibility that they had misled Congress in this one instance. I thought it was an interesting kind of subtle way of addressing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think if you look back at Panetta's congressional or Senate confirmation hearings when he was first being confirmed to be director of CIA, he made some pretty abrupt turns in the way he talked about the CIA as he was trying to get this job. It did seem to me that, you know, he saw his role as trying to bridge the perceived gap between the intelligence community and this new, more transparent administration that they, you know, were just a little bit wary of. And it strikes me that, you know, perhaps Panetta really does see a problem, that he needs to help solve, a morale problem. He talked about it at length in his confirmation hearings. When I read his letter in response to Nancy Pelosi's allegations, that was the first thing I thought of. I do think, though, that the CIA, you know, they do understand that there were lies propagated about the Iraq War in the lead up to it. But I think, you know, they might lay the blame higher above them than rather at the hands of the CIA themselves, you know, at the Bush administration for pressuring them to, you know, develop intelligence that related to very specific things that, you know, may not have given the full picture and may have simply been false. But it was more a question of the politics involved than it was just the CIA going off on its own and doing it. So I think the CIA's response would be, it's a reason to get politics out of the CIA, not a reason to launch a new investigation and inject politics into the CIA from a new angle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, certainly the CIA shouldn't be politicized, and the Bush administration was responsible for that, but the CIA had a duty to the people of the United States to give good intelligence and to not fall prey to the pressures from the administration, so they have to take full responsibility for what they've done.
No disagreement on that here.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Mike is next from Portage. Hi, Mike.
Hi. First, a comment that the guest expressed surprise that Obama mentioned abortion at Notre Dame. He's always been recognized that people have a fundamental different philosophy on things, whether it be the economy, abortion, or a number of other issues. And I think even in his acceptance speech, night he was on the election day, he said that he would listen, especially if he didn't agree with you. And so, sure. To me, that's the hallmark of Obama, is that he listens. He's a pragmatic person. Could be painted as a liberal when he was in Chicago. That was pragmatic point of view there. But more to the CIA. I think that Nancy Pelosi was misled. They said they used enhanced interrogation techniques, and then probably they may have even fudged it by just using the initials. And then kind of redirected the emphasis somewhere else. And she may be guilty of being naive and not reading between the lines as to what that actually meant. There was a guest recently, too, that was the Republican chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. The CIA said that he'd been briefed 4 times. He went back in his notebooks, which he's known for, and 3 of the dates that's actually impossible for, you know, he said, no, this isn't here, check again. And they came back and said, yep, we were mistaken. So that there was only 1 of the 4 dates that the CIA said that they briefed him, that he was actually briefed.
Right,
so I think
right.
The CIA
that was Senator Graham that I was talking about, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to talk over anyone. But I think that's really the question. And I'm afraid that this issue with Speaker Pelosi is, you know, going to end up distracting us. You know, this issue about who knew about what is going to, you know, someday surpass the question of whether, you know, the thing we're talking about was a crime in the first place.
Right.
And I think it's very interesting that seems to already be happening. I think it seems likely, based on who's in charge of Congress, that it won't completely eclipse the question of torture. But it does seem that, you know, the Republicans who are pushing for, you know, Speaker Pelosi's resignation and who are, you know, out there already defending the CIA, you know, it seems to me that they want Speaker Pelosi to be the issue and not what actually happened. And I doubt they will succeed, but it's interesting.
Thanks, Mike, very much for the call. Here's an interesting email. Why do you think torture events, Chase, are photographed so extensively?
Yeah, that too. You know, I think that surprised people a lot as well when those first Abu Ghraib photos came out. You know, we do know, for instance, that there are official documentation processes for, you know, any sort of waterboarding. There were tapes of the waterboardings that happened that were destroyed. I guess these photos, were generally just taken by people who were involved as souvenirs, from what I've heard, although I guess we don't know really this new batch of photos, whether that's still true. But, you know, that to understand the psyche and what would make someone torture, you know, even if they've been ordered to do certain things, you know, there are just dynamics involved where people, when they take on a certain role, will, you know, keep going deeper and deeper and deeper into, you know, the abyss. You know, once they're forced to start engaging in enhanced interrogation techniques or torture, it's just eventually their own souls will be broken, according to at least a lot of psychologists who have studied this sort of thing, going back to the Stanford prison experiment. So I do think that there's, you know, it would be interesting to study the psychology of all this, but, I don't think just pulling out one angle of it, like taking photos alone, would fully explain it. I think, you know, there's just a lot that goes on in your mind as you get put in this position where you have to torture people. You know, over time you start to think it's okay, and over time you start to think, maybe I'd like to have souvenirs of this, or, you know, maybe I'd like to remember this.
Right.
And you convince yourself, because you have to, that it's the right thing to do if you're being ordered to do it, or if you feel like, you know, you're being rewarded by your superiors for doing it, even if they haven't explicitly ordered you. However exactly it worked, when you're in that situation, you know, over time you start to die a little inside, I think.
Right. Let's talk just a little bit before we go back to calls. Many people want to talk about waterboarding and torture. We'll be back with you in a moment. The president may be naming a nominee for the Supreme Court sometime soon. There are reports that if he nominates one potential person, she'll be attacked as an outspoken supporter of abortion, another wanting to expand constitutional rights beyond the Constitution, another a prominent supporter of homosexual marriage. The Times had an interesting story today, quoting an operative in the Republican Party. It's an immense opportunity to build the conservative movement and identify the troops out there.
Sure. you know, I think that's exactly how they see it. But I think the main takeaway point is everybody knew before President Obama was elected that he was going to appoint a pro-choice judge. You know, whether or not any politician will ever say it in those words, because no one will admit that there exists a litmus test, you know, they probably won't. But, you know, I think the Republicans will likely use this to gin up contributions from their base, just as Democrats did back when the Republicans were appointing Supreme Court justices during President Bush's terms. So it certainly is true that this is straight out of both parties' playbooks. When you have something as definitive and you know, with as much finality as a Supreme Court nomination, and they really are the most, you know, arguably the most lasting decisions that the public pays attention to that the president and the Senate will make, you know, those are rife for all kinds of political manipulations and fundraising emails and, you know, all of that. So I do think that they see an opportunity there. But I think, you know, one of the more interesting results of Senator Arlen Specter's defection from the Republican Party to the Democrats is that he was the Republicans' go-to guy for judicial nominations. His staff was the staff that had almost always been charged with vetting judicial nominees, both under Republicans and under Democrats. You know, Specter has just a long history on the Judiciary Committee and, you know, having a hand in judicial nominations. And I think, you know, with Specter's defection and then with all of the folks you see in the Obama administration, including Vice President Biden, who, you know, basically invented the modern Senate confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court justice during the Bork hearings. You know, the Obama team has, you know, decades of experience confirming Supreme Court nominees. And at this point, I think the Republicans are going to be left a little bit in a lurch without Specter on their side to do their vetting.
Our number is 800-486-8655. Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent, is our guest for this All Things Political Monday. Jim from Waupun is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I think that we really need to get to the bottom of what happened with the Bush administration regarding torture in order for us to reclaim the moral high ground. And that I say that for very personal reasons. I'm first-generation German-American, and then when I was growing up, I remember my father, who left Germany in 1929 and came to this country, always telling us that you have to be very careful to question and to challenge some of these decisions that are made. I read a book recently called The Devil's Disciples. It's about Hitler's inner circle and how they made decisions. And as I was reading this 900-page book, I was struck, really, really struck, by how many of the arguments they made for invading other countries were based on the same, sounded so similar to the arguments about invading Iraq, that there was an external source of a very viable threat to Germany at the time from those countries, and they had to do that to save the fatherland. And I kept remembering growing up and being in high school in, you know, the early 60s and listening to social studies teachers talking about why the German government did what it did and how the German people did not respond and question. And I always felt a little uncomfortable, even though I'm first-generation German-American born here. My father was born there. And he came to this country because he figured they were moving so far to the right so fast after World War One that he thought they would replicate what they did with World War One, so he left. But in the social studies classes, I would hear these teachers saying, you know, why didn't they question what was going on in Germany at the time? And then I'd go home and tell my father these discussions, and he would say, well, listen, you have to understand, we were being, you know, people are being told that there's an external threat, and these things are being justified on that basis, and you have to be patriotic. So I don't think that those excuses worked in Nuremberg, you know, that we were just following orders. I think they have to get to the bottom of it to cleanse what happened. Otherwise, we're going to be quite at risk. One of the things my father always said was, by way of explanation of what happened in Germany rather than defense, he always said, wait till this country is attacked internally. Then you're going to see expediency used. And boy, I kept thinking of that after what happened after 9/11. It's quite instructive to make those comparisons, not that we're anything like the Nazis were, but in the process and decision-making, we're at great risk of losing our really democratic process if we don't get to the bottom of this.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Chase.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say I always enjoy very much talking to people who grew up in Germany in that time and who made it out or who didn't make it out, you know, because it is very interesting to hear their explanations. And I do think that, you know, they can really teach us a lot about what to avoid in our own society. And I think it's fair to say that, that there are maybe only a few possible rationales for an industrialized society to use to go to war, particularly if there isn't a real obvious self-defense claim to make to justify the war. So, whether or not, they intended to use the same rationale as the Third Reich, it seems plausible that their rationale would be similar simply because there aren't that many rationales available to justify a war, on that sort of scale. So I don't want to call the neoconservative movement Nazis or anything like that, but I do think it's interesting, and I think it's safe to say that, were it not for the fear that was instilled in all of us, perhaps rightfully, after September 11th, and the sense that we had that we needed to be vigilant and that we were going to need to make compromises, that pervaded Washington, D.C., perhaps none of this controversy that we're talking about would have happened, including, Speaker Pelosi's receiving this briefing that may or may not have been specific about the torture methods used, may or may not have been specific about, things being used now versus in the past or in the future. At the time, it was 2002, about a year after September 11th, and even if Speaker Pelosi at that time, Congresswoman Pelosi, had a problem with what she had heard, politically it may have been deadly. If she had come out publicly to, say, I learned this in a confidential intelligence briefing and I have problems with the fact that we might be torturing, if she had said that then, who knows, she might not have, she might have become too controversial and she may not be speaker right now. Mm-hmm. So I think, the politics of this, the way that the 9/11 attacks and other acts of terrorism have changed the politics of the United States, hopefully not permanently, but at least, for the past 6 years or 8 years, I do think it's dangerous. But I'm not sure whether any society would react differently, even knowing the lessons of Nazi Germany, unfortunately. It's human nature to cling to what you can be certain of in times when you fear for your life and your safety.
Thank you, Jim, so much for your call. We're going to be welcoming more in just one moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 18th of May. Chase Martin, our guest, managing editor of the Iowa Independent, the number 800-486-8655. And the email address, we're happy to take emails too, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Monday, the director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust. This is a fascinating thing that's going on, and it serves as the ultimate backup plan to save the world's food supplies. They have collected and stored small samples of hundreds of thousands of seeds that are located on islands near the Arctic Circle north of Norway. Norway has paid for this whole project, and we'll talk about it the second hour of our program. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. We go next to Dan from Muskego. Thanks for waiting, Dan. Hi.
Hi. My comment is about the torture. Basically, what I'm interested in is at the time that these interrogation techniques were being used, were they not considered acceptable techniques for interrogation? So how come we don't try and find out why they were acceptable as techniques at the time and figure out who made this okay in the first place? And if we already know that this is going on, then why are we even worried about having these photos released if we know it's going on? Why do we need more proof and it's already being admitted? So, it's like three questions, but...
All right,
sure,
Dan.
Well,
I think the issue of why it was acceptable practice, you know, is still in dispute. We can trace it back to memos, legal memos written by political appointees in the Bush administration. You know, we know who they are, and those memos are, you know, some of the few documents that we do have going back now to look at, you know, the rationale for torture or for enhanced interrogation techniques, I guess I should say. So we know that there was a legal rationale drafted by some administration lawyers, including one who, you know, has since been appointed by President Bush to the federal bench. Those legal memos, you know, any lawyer who hadn't worked for the Bush administration at the time looked at them and knew that they were just faulty legal reasoning that wouldn't hold up in court, that, you know, didn't follow precedents, did not follow the Geneva Convention, you know, seemed to ignore some very important parts of the law. So, you know, the question of whether anybody really took these rationales as true or whether they were just a fig leaf for the administration is unclear. The folks on the ground were clearly told that it was okay, and I don't think anybody blames them, you know, too much for not having, you know, countered these legal memos with their own legal reasoning if they weren't trained lawyers themselves. But, you know, the question of why they became accepted practice, I think, is the one question that we do know at least some part of the answer to. You know, whether or not that will lead to any kind of investigation of those people, or, you know, whether you can blame someone's lawyer for writing the memo that they were asked to write, whether you blame the person who asked them to write the memo in the first place. You know, clearly, at the very least, it seems we know, this was all designed to make it very difficult to assign blame to anyone. You know, there were these memos written so that the folks who weren't lawyers could say, well, we had these memos and we didn't know any different. And then the lawyers who wrote the memos can say, well, we were just doing what we were asked by our client, and you can't hold a lawyer accountable for, you know, doing what his client asks him to. You know, at a certain point, you're able to just point the finger in a different direction until there's no one, you know, with the overwhelming number of fingers pointed in their direction. And it makes it very difficult to do any sort of prosecution. So I think it was designed for that. But, you know, one of the few answers that we do have is how this rationale was built.
And thank you very much for your call. Bill is next from Orfordville. Hi, Bill.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
I have a hypothetical.
All right.
Okay, we have a Taliban. They have somehow secured one of the Pakistani nuclear devices. And we have a Taliban prisoner who knows when and where and how they're going to use it. Is torture ethical to find out that information?
That's a question that I'm happy to say is above my pay grade. You know, the ticking time bomb scenario, as it's called, is really, you know, that's obviously the exception that some people use to this, you know, debate about torture. If it's ever okay, it would be in this sort of a situation. You know, to be honest, I really don't think I've thought about that question to give you an answer. But I will say that probably the smartest answer that I've heard is simply that, you know, in that sort of situation, as long as it's not the stated policy of any administration to do it, if they do it once, going back, and it really, you know, and going back, we can know that it really did prevent an attack, the American people are probably not going to support a really huge, you know, prosecution of whoever it was who authorized it. But I think really the more interesting part of that is that most of the intelligence analysts that have been on TV recently or have been quoted in the newspaper or on the radio have basically said that this idea of the ticking time bomb scenario, whether or not, you know, hypothetically it's an interesting example or thought experiment to use, just doesn't happen in the real world quite like that. You know, once you have somebody who knows where a bomb is, either the bomb has been moved or they're not likely to give you good information about the location of the bomb, or you'd just be better off following up other leads. You know, enhanced interrogation will produce leads that are not reliable enough and likely to throw you off for a variety of reasons, I guess. But really, it's just that, you know, in the real world, that situation doesn't seem to come up as much as maybe we think it would.
How do you answer that question,
Bill? Well, going back, I'm 66 years old, so I have some reminiscence of World War II and my father's experience. He was with General Patton, and they actually shot prisoners. You know, because they were moving so fast and things like that. And in my experience in Vietnam, we did some interesting things there as well. I do think that when a country is involved in a military conflict, this kind of thing, no matter how many people you prosecute. And, of course, we don't have the experience of the Weimar Republic in Germany that brought Hitler to power here. I think you're going to continue to have this sort of thing because I think, as the speaker said, there's some fundamental issues in human nature that bring this sort of savage behavior to the forefront. I don't like it. I'm Christian. I pray against it. But I'm afraid we have to live with it. The devil is still among us.
Yeah, and I will say, though I'm uncomfortable expressing very many opinions out there, one thing that I will say for sure is whatever resolution we come to on this, I hope that it recognizes that the people on the ground are, you know, put in impossible situations, and war is messy, and we can't second guess every decision everybody made. You know, it's one thing to hold those in power accountable. It's another thing to recognize that, you know, the people out there really doing the dirty work, past a certain point, you really just can't blame them for doing things that they were put in a position where they had to do them.
Thank you, Bill, very much for the call. Mike is next from Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Two callers ago, the guy asked a really good question about the source, the foundation for these enhanced interrogation techniques, and the guest responded that it was essentially memos from within the Bush administration that was the source, the foundation of those, and that's not true at all. The guest probably wants to do a little bit more research before his next radio program. The foundation for the enhanced interrogation techniques was analysis done by the Defense Department using psychologists. It was a big study, and they determined that waterboarding itself did not create long-term, long-lasting psychological effects. Now, by the way, I do not agree that we should use waterboarding. I think in total it's a net negative for the country, but that was the conclusion of the study, and we do it on our own troops, by the way, when we go through SEER training. It's called survive, evade, resist, and escape training. They use waterboarding on the troops to show them what they may encounter when they get captured. So the foundation is there to use this thing, and that's what the memos and everything else is based on, and that's, by the way, the discussion that occurred within these briefings in the Intelligence Committee, which Jane Harman heard, and she wrote a letter concurring to that, in which Leon Panetta is fully aware of, and which anybody else that was in those briefings heard of. So that's why this Pelosi thing is crazy. I mean, everybody knew about it. So for her to even make the statements, it's preposterous. So I don't know if the guest knows anything about the SEER training and the basis for these studies, but
sure,
that was the foundation.
Yeah. Well, the SEER training manual obviously did lay out the techniques that were to be used to train our own troops to, you know, resist torture and resist interrogations from the enemy. The legal memos that were written, though, were the ones that set the standard for if it doesn't result in permanent organ failure, or if it doesn't result in, you know, X amount of harm for X amount of years, or, you know, whatever those studies said in particular, and I'll trust that you know more about them than I do, but it was the legal memos that set out that said that those standards that they were researching to figure out which techniques fit within them and which ones didn't, that those standards were adherent to the Geneva Conventions. And most people, at least most of the legal scholars who have come out since, analyzing these memos, would say that even if we use SEER training on our own troops, and even if we conclude that waterboarding doesn't cause permanent organ failure, it's still torture, because the definition of torture doesn't actually have very much to do with permanent organ failure or the other standards that they laid out in those studies for SEER training. So while you're right to say that I oversimplified my answer on that previous question, I do think it was the legal memos that really provide the smoking gun, or at least are the crux of any investigation, because that's really where it went from just a question of researching different techniques for use on our own soldiers to a question of, well, what can we get away with? You know, how can we finagle the Geneva Conventions and other statutes that we have against torture so that we are allowed to do these particular techniques?
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue that those standards that they set up in that research that they did for the SEER manual really, at the time, wasn't really related to torturing other countries' prisoners. And once they got around to that, it was really, you know, those memos that justified it rather than the SEER manual itself.
And thank you very much for your call. Well, that's about it. I wish we had time for more calls. We have a lot of calls here today. Chase, thank you very much. Big decisions coming this week. Could we get a Supreme Court nomination by the end of the week, do you think?
I'm hearing that it's going to be next week.
Next week?
Between Memorial Day and the president leaving for Egypt.
Oh. There is so much going on with this administration, isn't it? It's just big things, one day after another, after another, after another.
Yeah, we live in exciting times, at the very least.
Yeah, we do. Thanks, Chase, as always. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's a great time.
Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent, and that's online at iowaindependentaltogether.com, iowaindependent.com. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls today. We do All Things Political every Monday at 9 o'clock, so if you want to keep that in mind, we look at the week's political news the week before and what's happened over the weekend and cover a wide range of topics. So this is something that's always on our schedule, Mondays at 9. We have news coming up from National Public Radio and then another fascinating hour ahead, something that I didn't know very much about, and I'm sure that you knew more than I did because you're a smart audience. But we'll talk about these seeds that are being stored in an island very close to the Arctic, Norwegian Island. So that's coming up. Stay with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.